Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, January 12, 2024. Wishing everyone a safe and happy new year as the struggle continues for social justice in 2024. And so today on the show, we put the spotlight on Brazil on the one-year anniversary of the January 8th insurrection attempt by right-wing supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro. We'll also discuss the influence of right-wing supporters of Donald Trump in Brazilian politics and the importance of combating fake news as well. All that and much more with our guest today, who's Michael Fox, who's a freelance media producer. He's also the host and producer of the podcast Brazil on Fire, which was a co-production between NACLA and Real News Network. And he's also the producer of the upcoming podcast Under the Shadow, which we'll discuss later on in the program today. But in the meantime, welcome back to the show, Michael Fox.
Thank you so much, Oscar.
Absolutely. This is going to be one of those stories about where do we begin? You know what I'm saying? As far as the January 8th insurrection attempt almost a year ago, almost this week, actually, in Brazil. And so as this marks the one-year anniversary of the attempted insurrection in Brasilia by supporters of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, you know, it's hard to see how do we measure this as far as resolve and insecurity or sort of vulnerability when it comes to Brazilian democracy. So, for example, this week, the English version of El País and the Associated Press, you know, referred to the country as still recovering. But as one could imagine, the current government of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva will display probably some degree of resolve on the one-year anniversary of the insurrection attempt on January 8th of last year. So with that in mind, what is your assessment 1 year after this insurrection? There's probably a balancing act here that's pretty hard to not only define, but also to find a really satisfying conclusion.
Well, always, right? Always. Well, several things I think are important to say, Oscar. First off, on January the 8th, on the anniversary, Lula met with the heads of all the different branches of government, many of the governors of the country in Brasilia, in the National Congress, to remember this date, to look back, and to also carry forward. And it was titled Unshakable Democracy, this event. And it recalls back, reminds us back to kind of what happened in the wake of the January 8th attack, where Lula met with all the different heads of the different branches of power, with all the governors in the country, and they all walked across Brasilia to assess the damages together overnight and to show that the country was united. Remember, looking back exactly 1 year ago, 90% of the population was against the attacks in Brasilia. And so I think that's important to look at what the government, A, on the anniversary has done. But, you know, Oscar, one really important way to assess where we are 1 year later is also to compare this with the January 6th in the United States and the investigations into January 6th. And if you compare that, things in Brazil have moved much, much faster. There's been two parliamentary investigations. One of them found that Bolsonaro was one of the intellectual authors of what happened. And we'll dive into that. We'll get a little bit deeper into that. There's been the Supreme Court investigation. Remember that just in a couple of days after the attack, roughly 1,400 people were jailed and held for a long period of time. We've seen 30 people who have convicted and charged with serving up to 17 years of jail time for destroying the country's democracy and a number of other details. The other 1,300 and some odd people are still, like, they haven't been officially brought to court. They've been released, but they are not innocent. They have not been exempted from legal trials. And so that's going to be happening in the coming months, over the next years. We're going to see what happens. Remember, this also happened. January 8th took place after weeks of Bolsonaro supporters camped out in front of military barracks across the country. And that's important too, because people were also jailed around those military barracks. As soon as January 8th happened, then Lula took charge and really put the pressure on the police and the military to remove people from those barracks across the country and really push back on this movement. And so those people who actually didn't invade the capital itself have been, there's been hundreds of people who are now have to do community service and have promised they won't ever do it again. But there's a lot of other people, dozens of people who are wearing ankle bracelets and are under preventative prison right now because of what's happened. So the pushback from the Brazilian government has been strong. The Supreme Court investigations are still happening. In fact, they've just discovered about a month ago, one of the first financiers, and this is one of the things that Lula said just this week, was he said, listen, the investigations cannot stop until we know who financed it, who was behind it, A, who were the actors, the intellectual authors, but also who financed this. And so they've identified at least two people, one person in the state of Paraná who paid for buses to ship people north to Brasilia. Another person has been arrested in the city of Salvador who also paid for a bus. But what's complicated is that things are very horizontal. Like things are like the as far as the investigation looks and what they've been talking about, a lot of the funds and the financing has happened. It wasn't just one or two people that did it. It was pretty grassroots across the right-wing movement. And that's made it hard for them to identify exactly who was financing all this and who was, putting up the money for the different buses to bring people here and there. But we know that those two people definitely have. And so looking back 1 year later, one of the major critiques that we do have that a lot of you have talked about is that no military officials, no members of the military have been brought to justice or have been brought to trial because of this. And we know that members of the military were involved. They kind of let people walk in. The military and the police, security in Brasilia just kind of let people walk in. And in part, that had to do with the fact that the person who was in charge of security in Brasilia that day was Bolsonaro's former justice minister. And he basically said, okay, it's a free-for-all, do what you want, right? And so he allowed the destruction of the Brazilian capital to happen, roughly $4 to $5 million, which was the amount of damage that occurred in Brasilia that we know. And so it's a devastating, obviously it was a devastating moment. And a lot of people are looking back now. They're taking like kind of this week and these days to look back, understand what happened, but also look back and what does this mean within Brazilian democracy at the time. And I just want, before we move on, I just want to read a quote from Brazil's former Supreme Court Minister, Ricardo Lewandowski, because he said something this week, which I think is really key. He said, you know, fortunately, the institutional mechanisms for defending democracy in Brazil were effective in defeating the coup threats. However, the specter of authoritarianism continues to haunt us as the agents of chaos and discord continue alive, although momentarily withdrawn, waiting for the most favorable moment to launch new coups. So I think this puts it into context. Like, the Brazilian institutions worked. They shut down the threat. People are being held responsible. People are going to jail. There have been investigations. The Supreme Court is moving forward. Remember Alexandre Moraes, who's one of the main Supreme Court justices who really pushed back against Bolsonaro during his government. And he's been kind of leading the charge in terms of the Supreme Court investigation into January 8th. But at the same time, this kind of specter of authoritarianism, the specter of possible pro-Bolsonaro, far-right violence still exists in Brazil. And this, I think, is really concerning, you know, in the as we're looking in the States and we're seeing like a new Trump run for the presidency, you know, like,
yeah.
Let's not forget that in the same way that January 6th in the United States or January 8th in Brazil, these were not necessarily coups that the goal was to actually stop the process in the United States or overturn the election in Brazil and Lula's inauguration, have the military come back. They were attempts to destabilize the country. They were attempts to sow chaos. And, you know, if we look at the larger vision of what, say, Steve Bannon, you know, Trump's former White House analyst and the guy who has pushed the whole fake news, election rigging, fake election discourse from Trump to Bolsonaro, his whole thing is about sowing chaos. It's about, and then with that chaos, creating the imaginary or the imagery of what could happen, right? And so it is as much, the attack on January 8th, the attack on January 6th, is as much about creating this moment of hope and excitement among the far right as this symbol, right? As it is about actually creating a coup in the moment, which was never going to succeed in Brazil. And that, I think we need to understand it, because look at Trump, you know, he's making another run for the presidency. Now, Bolsonaro has been, and I think we should talk about this, Oscar, he has been blocked from running for re-election for the next 8 years, but that doesn't mean that his people and his movement can't, right?
And that goes all back to what I mentioned at the beginning, which is sort of this delicate balancing act as to how to assess this all 1 year later. Because you're right, the democratic institutions in Brazil held firm, stayed in place, and withstood this insurrection. But at the same time, you know, as you mentioned in your Brazil on Fire podcast, that the right wing in Brazil, especially the fascist elements, are equally as strong. And could this happen again? Who knows? We certainly hope not. But, you know, January 8th, nonetheless, in Brazil is a cause for concern and a cautionary tale at the very least. Now, you just mentioned Jair Bolsonaro being banned from running for office until 2030. What do you make of this decision? You know, if you could expand a little bit more by the Brazilian court, because as we're having this conversation this month, there seems to be a movement here in the U.S. of barring Donald Trump from certain states for January 6th here in the U.S. So what do you make of this? Because it may come across as a slippery slope in the U.S., but in Brazil, how do you make of this? Because, again, the decision's already been made in Brazil that he's barred altogether from running for office until 2030. So can you further expand on that?
Yeah. And actually, Oscar, this is such an important point. I did a story about this when it happened in late June and ended up doing a story for The Real News about this and making the connection to the United States, comparing Brazil with the United States about the situation. So I'm so glad we're going to dive into this.
It's unavoidable. We're going to make the comparisons.
It's unavoidable. But it's really important to understand what free speech means in Brazil and the United States, and how far supposed free speech is allowed to go. So the Supreme Court banned Bolsonaro from running back in late June for the next 8 years because of a meeting that he held with foreign ambassadors in which he spread fake news about the electoral system, basically said it was rigged, spread information. And they looked back at that date. This was in the lead up to obviously last year, not last year's now, the 2022 elections. And what the Supreme Court did was they looked back at that moment when he was spreading this fake news throughout this meeting and then on social media channels. And in fact, Alexandre Moraes, the Supreme Court justice who I mentioned earlier, his quote at the time was, he spread lies, fraudulent information. They were not opinion. It was actual lies, right? And this is really important because basically what the Supreme Court ruled at that time, and there could be even be more consequences. Remember, I mean, Bolsonaro is just like Trump. He made many, many statements, and this was just the very first. It was just the tip of the iceberg, many analysts believe. But basically what they said was Bolsonaro, his free speech rights in the United States did not trump the country's democracy. The country's democratic norms and the country's electoral system was more important than Bolsonaro's right to spread lies and disinformation. And that is why they made this ruling. He was the first president in Brazilian history or former president to ever be ruled against for electoral violations. And that's what this was. And basically, he said that the elections were rigged. And that's why the Supreme Court said, you cannot run for the next 8 years. Now, I've been speaking with legal scholars that kind of cross the borders between Brazil and the United States. And the main thing that they've talked about is how much in the United States, how sacrosanct, how important are free speech rights. And we've often in the past, we thought about free speech rights as a really positive thing, right? I mean, obviously that's how we've won civil liberties. That's how we've been able to fight for our rights. But when we start to get into the world of fake news, this gets really complicated because the United States still defends people's right to share and spread fake news, even in a case when that is an actual affront or attack against U.S. democracy. And what many legal scholars at the time, a few months ago that I was speaking with, told me was that, okay, so Bolsonaro's banned, but the possibility that Trump might be banned for what he has said against the U.S. electoral system is much less. Now, I love the fact that you brought up what's been happening lately in Maine and in some other states where they're actually...
In Colorado,
where they're actually banning Trump from being on the ballots in those states. And I think that's kind of like the only option, you know, we have. Of course, it's a different situation. The United States, its electoral system is all broken up state by state. So it's almost the states themselves that have to do this. You don't have an overall electoral council like you have in Brazil and so many other countries in the Western Hemisphere that rule over the elections with an electoral court. And so it is really state by state that has to do this. But we still have this complicated notion of the right of free speech rights in the United States, even when they pertain to disinformation, fake news, and lies. And this is really important, Oscar, and we need to understand. I actually been thinking about doing a longer series of stories about this to get to be able to wrap our heads about this in the United States. Because I don't think, you know, people will talk about, oh, free speech, and oh, his right to do this. And oh, you know, even like Glenn Greenwald, his whole thing where, you know, he, this investigated journalist who talked a lot, but his whole thing is about his right to say anything he wants to, and he will defend Trump, and he will defend Bolsonaro, and he will appear on Fox News all he wants to, because all his whole thing is about is the freedom to say whatever he wants. But it doesn't matter if that's attacking the country's democracy. It doesn't matter if that's fake news, right? And we need to really wrap our heads around this and understand the United States within the context of Brazil and other countries, because in Europe, the EU and the European Union is starting to push back also on this question of, do I really have the right to spread information and fake news? And how much can that be regulated, or should it be regulated by social media? And so these are new things we're trying to grapple with, I think, in this world. particularly this new world of social media and fake news and all this over the last couple decades, Brazil is on the forefront of really pushing back. Alexandre de Moraes has shown that in this last elections, where if fake news came out, he changed the law. Originally, it was like social media platforms had something like 24 hours to take down whatever the fake news that they ruled fake news. And then during the election, there was so much of it, he actually decreased the amount of time they had to like 2 hours. So it meant that social media platforms had to take it down, or they could go off air, or they could be fined by the Supreme Electoral Court in Brazil. And so they're taking drastic action that I do not see the United States having the means to take, which is why fake news will be continue to be so prominent. It always is. This is the new world we're living in. But in the United States, this is going to be a problem over the next year.
Let's continue this issue on fake news, because you wrote an article for The World in May of last year, 2023, about this fake news bill that was being proposed in Brazil. And just to give you an idea of, you know, how bad fake news is as it pertains to Brazil, let's go to our old friend Tucker Carlson before he got ousted at Fox News. And just to give you an idea of sort of the things that, you know, again, it's unavoidable to point out the U.S. as it pertains to fake news with what took place in Brazil in January. So here's a clip from a year ago, following the January 8th insurrection in Brazil, on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News.
Consider what is happening tonight in Brazil. So thanks to what was very clearly a rigged election, a convicted criminal called Lula da Silva is now the president of the most important country in South America. Millions of people in Brazil understand exactly what happened. They know that their democracy has been hijacked, possibly forever. Lula may be a criminal, in fact he is, but he has the full support of both the Biden administration and the Chinese government. So the obvious question is, why are protesters in Brazil so angry? Well, they're angry because the new Lula government has eliminated their most basic civil liberties. Lula is working to turn Brazil into a Chinese-style dictatorship, and he's doing it very quickly with maximum aggression.
So that was a clip from the Tucker Carlson show on Fox News that aired the week of the January 8th insurrection in Brazil. And so, and to be honest, he wasn't alone in that sort of fake news that we just heard right there. So let's expand upon this fake news bill that you reported on for The World in May of last year. To what extent can this actually combat fake news? Because as you just said, it's a challenge that unfortunately we have to live with. And it just shows that there's a significant amount of fake news from the U.S. to Brazil on a variety of things, whether it be January 8th or on Lula and all this other nonsense that Tucker Carlson, you know, mentioned in the clip.
It's just mind-boggling. It's ridiculous. You know, what's really hard here too, Oscar, is even local efforts in one country to combat fake news in that country cannot touch, you know, fake news coming from, say, Tucker Carlson from the United States or from other countries, yeah. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Like, this is one of the major challenges that we live in this super, uber internationalized world where social media is just running rampant. And so this is really complicated. And what's fascinating is if you look back just over the last few years, right after the elections, 2022 elections, which Lula won, there was a huge push in English by folks in the United States sending fake news and propaganda about rigged elections happening back to Brazil over social media. And so you see kind of this cross-border organizing that's happened by the far right, and that stuff that I've talked about in the past and talking, you know,
in the Brazil on Fire podcast.
Of course, thank you so much. If you haven't heard it, you should check it out. And let's not forget, you know, Bolsonaro's own sons, Eduardo Bolsonaro, who's a member of Congress, and he is the head of the movement, which is Steve Bannon's head of the movement in South America and Latin America. That's Steve Bannon's like far right organizing tool. So all these different people, groups, and networks, they're all linked up. And that's how they're able to push things, regardless of what the local laws are in one country or another. So, and we saw it clearly with Tucker Carlson. I mean, Tucker Carlson came, I don't remember when he was in country, but he was in Brazil for a couple weeks and he did a bunch of reporting. He goes back and now he can talk about Brazil as if he knows what's happening and talk about Lula, mind-boggling. By the way, let me just say, Oscar, that Lula is not a criminal, right? The charges against him that were done by a corrupt judge, Sergio Moro, who clearly was in cahoots with members of the prosecution to take down Lula. And all of the charges against Lula have been thrown out. So just to point that there, so that just make, just because that's something that still people believe, that Lula was corrupt and somehow he got out, and you know, and everyone believes that Bolsonaro is still president, which is mind-boggling. But it's such a parallel with the United States. You know, it's such a parallel with the United States. And it is so, it's an extremely complicated world to try and fight back on this fake news stuff.
Yes, and there'll be even more parallels in a moment. We're going to take a break right here. When we come back, we'll mention the curious case of Jason Miller, not to be confused with Stephen Miller, who's the anti-immigrant white nationalist who's hell-bent on making the U.S. a white country. So we'll deal with that even more when we come back from the break. In the meantime, we're speaking with Michael Fox, who's a freelance media producer, the producer of the Brazil on Fire podcast, and the producer of the upcoming podcast, Under the Shadow. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Quase hétero, etérea massa, complexo de não se entender. Um canalha, quase hétero, ignorar amor por complexo, medo de nele se ver. É necessário quebrar os padrões. É necessário abrir discussões, alento pra alma, amar sem portões, amores aceitos sem imposições, singulares, plural. Se te dói em ouvir, em mim dói, no carnal. Mas se tem um jeito, esse meu jeito de amar. Amar, que lhe dá o direito de ver.
That was Criollo, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the one-year anniversary of the January 8th insurrection in Brazil. We have freelance media producer Michael Fox, who's also the host and producer of the Brazil on Fire podcast and the producer of the upcoming podcast, Under the Shadow. So I want to talk to you right now about Jason Miller, who, again, not to be confused with Stephen Miller, because upon the January 8th insurrection in Brazil, immediate reports by the AP and Reuters mentioned his name along with Steve Bannon. So just to be clear, Jason Miller is a former Trump advisor and who has been equally in cahoots, shall we say, with Steve Bannon over the years. And it's a curious case for me because CNN actually reported one time that he was actually detained by Brazilian authorities for questioning at an airport before he left the country. I point that out to you, Michael, because that CNN report was in 2021, almost a year and a half, actually, before the January 8th insurrection in Brazil. And so, again, he has ties to Steve Bannon, which we shouldn't gloss over about his importance when it comes to fake news. But what more can you tell me, if possible, about Jason Miller and his connection with Steve Bannon and all these other American right-wing figures that, as we mentioned before the break, have their fingerprints all over fake news when it comes to Brazilian politics?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. First off, I just saw the news recently that he is rejoining Trump's team again for Trump's run at the 2024 elections. He is also stepping down. So he's been the CEO of Getter. So that's the right-wing social media platform, kind of like the right-wing Twitter.
Yeah.
And so he's stepping down from that to rejoin Trump. Now, the reason it's important to understand, I'm glad you're asking about September 2021. So that was one of the first Brazil CPAC conferences, right? Conservative yes. Political Action Conference.
He was there for CPAC, exactly.
So he was there for CPAC, but they tied that conference, I am sure, to Brazilian Independence Day, September 7th. And if you remember what happened that day, there was a huge push into the lead up of that September 7th, where Bolsonaro was calling on his people to turn out. And it seemed like the fears across Brazil was that what was going to happen that September 7th was what happened on January the 8th, a year and a half later. That's what people thought was in the works. So he was calling on his people to hit Brasilia. He was calling on his people to turn out. He had been talking about it for such a long time. He had been talking about the lead up to elections. And what people kind of thought or could imagine was some sort of like internal self-coup, as we've seen oftentimes, where an authoritarian leader kind of takes over and takes over the different branches of government, and the tanks roll and he comes to power as more of a dictator. And that was kind of the fear that people believed could be happening on that September 7th. Of course, you know, there's the old cliche, what is the term, that you don't announce a coup? And he had been announcing it for months, calling on his people to turn out. And so, but it's very clear that Jason Miller was in town for the CPAC conference, and he was in town for the huge September the 7th protests and rallies in support of Bolsonaro. And that year it was massive. And I remember for months ahead of time, people were asking, oh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Because it was, you remember, it came in the heels of months of Bolsonaro attacking the different branches of government, attacking the Supreme Court, attacking Congress, attacking governors. And in fact, insinuating that the military should move the Supreme Court ministers out and whatnot. And so this is where Jason Miller appears. So he was obviously there for this big Bolsonaro moment. He was detained by authorities. Remember that, you know, people have this kind of vision a lot of times of, you know, if Bolsonaro is in power, then the entire Brazilian government is right wing. And in this case, you know, the Supreme Court was very much independent. The Supreme Court was the main institution that was pushing back against Bolsonaro. And there were investigations into kind of what was Bolsonaro trying to do with the September 7th. You know, so we don't know why and how he was detained for a period of time for questioning, but it's, we can assume that it had something to do with that, understanding what his role was, what he was doing, and what was happening around September the 7th in the case that there was some sort of a coup attempt. And it is fascinating. I mean, we like the September 7th, 2021, and then there was kind of a re-up of the September 7th, 2021 in 2022, a year later. Of course, that was like one of the main big rallies that Bolsonaro was trying to do in the lead up to the elections of 2022. And those were moments where a lot of people were saying, oh, is this going to be it? Is this going to be the January 6th moment in Brasilia? You know, and no, he waited till actually after Lula had been inaugurated to then attempt the January 8th. So it's totally tied in, but that's who he is. And that's why he was in Brazil. And it shows the deep ties between US Trump figures, Bolsonaro, Brazil. It runs deep, there's no doubt. And obviously these figures are extremely excited about Trump's reelection, but also excited about more figures like Bolsonaro coming to power in the region.
You know, even though CNN reported on these things as it pertains to Jason Miller, it should be also noted that CNN had Jason Miller as a talking head and as a contributor regularly on CNN prior to, you know, recent events that like what we've been discussing here. So just food for thought there on that note. So, and that sort of segues into US corporate media as it pertains to this whole mess that took place a year ago in Brazil, because late last year, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, did a report, you know, on U.S. basically suppressing, you know, the government's role in ousting Brazil's government. And they were referring to the period when Dilma Rousseff was impeached and ousted almost 8 years ago now. And so it's not fake news per se, but it is deception by omission by corporate media to not mention these sort of things that have taken place not just recently in the last year or two, and not just recently during the Bolsonaro administration, but going back to the Dilma Rousseff years, as far as this U.S. hostility towards governments like that of Brazil, like that of Lula, and to an extent, Dilma Rousseff as well. So it comes across to me, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but it seems like in the context of Brazil, and everything that we've been discussing so far that's taken place in the last few years, it almost seems like fake news is like a modern day expression of U.S. imperialism, you know, especially when it comes to economics here, because we are talking about one of Latin America's strongest economies, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. I like that idea of fake news being an expression of imperialism. I think what's interesting about that idea and that concept, of course, is that it's not just U.S. It can be, it's kind of across the board, you know, like it's used by the far right, pseudo fascist authoritarian groups trying to sow chaos wherever it might be. But it is absolutely an attempt to destabilize by groups that don't have the means to be able to push their message in any other way, but also the power of, you know, creating these networks like Getter, you know, creating these kind of troll farms, as we've seen in other places, like what Bukele has done in order to, you know, push back on his own, on people in the country and on his adversaries and stuff like that. So, and of course, the hate cabinet that was Bolsonaro's kind of pseudo unofficial cabinet, where top social media influencers together with members of close allies would create memes and just use fake news with just utter disregard to really push their message across Brazil. And that's thankfully something the Supreme Court has pushed back on and was able to really push back on. I mean, we have to understand that Bolsonaro's election happened on the heels of the utter destruction of the political system of the country, right? First, the coup against Dilma Rousseff, which was absolutely a coup. They said that she had done budgeting maneuvers. And the reality is that she was doing the same, you know, she was balancing the budget the same way that other members of Congress have always done and other governors have always done. But they use that as a ploy to remove her from power because members of the conservative and the far right wanted her out. And so they were able to Machiavellian, you know, remove her from power. In fact, the Senate legalized officially legalized the very thing that they had removed her from power for the day after her impeachment, which is just such a sign that it's just mind boggling. Right. But yet in so much international reporting, it was talked about as though she was wrapped up in the same corruption scandals that were hitting the Workers' Party and hitting so many other members of kind of conservative and central parties. And absolutely, it's important to remember that, you know, behind all of that, remember the U.S. was spying on Dilma's government. The U.S. was spying on Petrobras, which is the state, you know, oil company. And so all of this is happening behind the scenes. Dilma is removed. The person that is slated to come back into power is, of course, Lula. And then he's jailed and trumped up charges and removed. And of course, that opens the door for Bolsonaro, as we talk about, you know, in Brazil on Fire.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to look at the omission in media or in mainstream media and corporate media or backing of certain narratives, particularly narratives that are in line with, say, the United States or U.S. interests. As kind of a front runner or a forerunner to fake news, you know, or what we think about as fake news, omitting information or skirting around information to only talk about things that make other people seem what they're not is also a form of fake news, right? That absolutely counts. So it's just on steroids now, and everyone has the means and accessibility to do it, and then you have outlets like Breitbart. That or Epic Times or whatever it may be that are able to push fake news to such a level that people were literally living in two different worlds, in two different societies or multiple different worlds. You know, it's crazy though, Oscar. I was in Venezuela. I lived there for several years in the mid 2000s. I remember the first time I went there though was in 2004. It was in the wake of the attempted coup against Chavez 2002. Yeah. And I was shocked by the amount of fake news that was happening in Venezuela by the mainstream private media at the time. I walked at one moment, I was with a friend in the center of the city and his mom called him frantic because there was a massive protest happening and he had to make sure he did not go to the center of Caracas. He could not go there because there was this massive protest. She had just seen it on TV. And then he hangs up with her and I was like, what's going on? He's like, she says there's a protest happening right where we are. And there was nothing. It was completely fabricated. It was made up. And that's what the coup against Chavez was in 2002. It was a fabricated media coup. And so it's fascinating, though, to look 20 years on. Here we are. And that same model has been replicated to so many other countries, including the United States. Whereas at that point, it was still mainstream media that was doing it in cahoots with, you know, top members of the opposition, whatever else. But now you have this whole fake news machine, but fake news machine together with, you know, far right media or outlets that are able to create these memes and push these memes. There are still people behind the scenes and groups behind the scenes that are pushing this in order to achieve their ends, right? And I think that's really important for us to remember.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's gotten even worse because what took place in Venezuela during that time period, there was no Twitter or Facebook or YouTube during that time. And now it's become even more accessible, the issue of fake news. That's why I mentioned, you know, the FAIR report on Brazil. And considering what you just said as well, you know, I think both you and FAIR make the same point, is that these sort of things, particularly January 8th in Brazil, don't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
There's a much larger and broader history that requires contents, requires nuance. And by not including that, it's, as we just said, deception by omission. And so I want to take this opportunity now to discuss your latest project, Under the Shadow, because I heard the trailer. It sounds fantastic. And I get the impression that that's another underlying theme that you'll be hitting on, much like you did in the Brazil on Fire podcast, is that all these things, whether it be Brazil or any other parts of Latin America, the things that we see in present day and time as far as the fragility of certain democracies don't happen in a vacuum. But please tell me more about this new project that you have coming out soon.
That is absolutely it, Oscar. We cannot understand Central America. We can't understand Latin America. We can't understand Brazil. And I say Central America because that's the focus of Under the Shadow, is largely on Central America, which is where I've been focused over the last year. We can't understand it today without walking back in time to understand the role of the U.S. government in tanking its ability to flourish and grow, and in gutting, you know, democracy, and in destroying human rights. And so what I do in the podcast is I'm walking in the present. I go to specific places where things happened, and then I walk back in time to understand what was going on, why that was an important spot, but then understand all the context around it. So I start off actually walking back in time to understand Monroe, the Monroe Doctrine. Right? That's the that's the basis of 200 years of U.S. Imperialism and intervention in Latin America. And then I look, in the introduction, I look very deeply at migration today because, you know, these two things, U.S. intervention, migration, are in most people's minds completely disassociated. There is no connection. There's migration happening and people trying to get to the United States. And then there's U.S. intervention. But you can't disassociate the two because it is U.S. integration, U.S. intervention and U.S. imperialism abroad that destroys the ability and tanks countries. And that is what in so many cases causes migration. And these are the connections that I make. So I walk with migrants. I visit migrants along the migrant trail in Tapachula in southern Mexico. And then I make these connections, you know, to the past and to the present. So that's kind of the introduction. And then I walk, we go from northern Central America and work all the way down to Panama. So we go through Guatemala, two episodes on Guatemala, two on El Salvador, two in Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama. In order to understand, to look at the present and then understand the past. Historical memory is really important in this issue. I mean, we don't talk about that in the United States very much, but it's so key for Latin America. And so I visit a lot of places, memorials for the dead and the disappeared, to understand what happened there then, the role of the U.S. government, and what does it feel like? What does it look like today? In Guatemala, I go to, and Guatemala is, you know, obviously really important when this episode airs. Just in 2 days later, we're going to have the inauguration of Bernardo Arevalo, right, in Guatemala. So that's really key, and that's why I wanted to start this
podcast. Fingers crossed, by the way.
Fingers crossed, right, of course. You just never know. They've been pushing back on him so much. But that's why I wanted to launch this series this week. And so I go to the town of Tiquisate in Guatemala, which is a former, it was basically founded by the United Fruit, a former massive banana, U.S. banana corporation. And I walk back in time to understand the role of United Fruit in Guatemala. And then, of course, the 1954 CIA coup, which overthrew democratic presidents and stopped, you know, Guatemala's 10-year, 11-year exciting experience of what they call the democratic spring in Guatemala.
Yeah.
And of course, that was the first president in true president, democratically elected president in Guatemala, is the father of Bernardo Arevalo, who we're hoping gets inaugurated this coming weekend. And then in the next episode, I walk to the 1980s. And so I visit a memorial for the dead and the disappeared in Comalapa, to understand the role of the U.S. And then, you know, throughout the series, I go to U.S. military bases, look at the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989, and CIA operations, Iran-Contra, William Walker, you know, the filibuster who invaded Nicaragua back in the 1850s and took over the country. It's just mind-boggling. But I really try and set this scene of, A, the United States has used Latin America as a training ground for its imperialist tendencies forever, as so many people have talked about in the past. And then look at if we cannot understand Latin America today, the difficulties it's facing, the corruption, the gangs, whatever else, without understanding the role of the United States in detonating any sort of democracy that these countries have always had. Like we think of the United States as spreading democracy, but what it's actually done is destroyed it. with the intention of bringing to power, propping up authoritarian regimes, because those were the people that would tag the U.S. line, particularly throughout, obviously, you know, the Cold War and the fight against so-called communism, but going back and protecting U.S. Business interests in the region back all the way into the 1800s. So this is the series. I'm super excited about it. It's been in the back of my head, something like this has been in the back of my head for over a decade. And it's been exciting being able to travel to, you know, I lived in El Salvador back 20 years ago. And so it's been exciting to be able to go to all these different places, see things today. I've been with my family traveling. And so being able to show them and introduce them to all these friends and to see all these
fantastic
different things. So, and it is, I mean, at least the introduction and some of these series are some of the, I think it's some of the best work I've ever done.
Fantastic. And you mentioned the issue of migration and U.S. intervention. You're talking to the product of migration and U.S. intervention here. So
yeah,
fantastic. And we're almost out of time here, but don't fret, because next week we're scheduled to have Professor Jorge Cuellar on the show, who actually had an interview with Michael Fox in NACLA. And he spoke about, you know, the anti-mining movement in Panama, and we'll sure to expand upon that next week on the show. And if it's anything as good as the Brazil on Fire podcast, then I think people will be in for a treat. And so I'm really hoping people will check this out. So Michael, before we let you go, where can people follow you on Twitter, and give us the dates one more time?
Well, Twitter, mfox_US. The first three episodes of the podcast are launching this week, this Tuesday. And by the time this show airs, it should already be out. So Oscar, I'll pass you the link that you can maybe put in the show notes if you like. And you can also follow me and check me out on Patreon. I'm doing a lot of stuff on there, uploading different pictures for the podcast and other stories and stuff and links, and obviously. So Patreon.com/MFOX and the series, it's, you know, it'll be 11, it's an 11 episode series with some extra stuff. So it'll be, it starts in here in January, but it should be going on until March or so.
Absolutely. And I could say that I'm very curious to see what you do as it pertains to both Costa Rica and Panama, because those are two countries that we don't discuss as often as we should when it comes to the struggle for social justice. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, it'll be fantastic. And before we go, we just want to give a shout out as well to both NACLA and the Real News Network for their co-production and fantastic support for the Brazil on Fire podcast as well. So we've been speaking with Michael Fox, who's a freelance media producer and the host and producer of the upcoming podcast, Under the Shadow. As always, it's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you very much for being on the show with us, Michael Fox.
Thanks so much, Oscar. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert Drowns with some brief news headlines. Republican governors in 15 states are blocking students from accessing a federal summer food assistance program. The program would provide up to $120 per school-aged child for each month of the summer, supplementing the free or reduced-price lunches they receive during the school year. The deadline for states to opt into the program was January 1st, and only 35 states chose to do so. GOP governors defended their inaction in various ways, with Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen saying, quote, "I don't believe in welfare." Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds suggested without evidence that the food assistance program might fuel childhood obesity. Wholesale price inflation in the United States fell from November to December, another indication the economy has moved away from peak inflationary pressures. The Labor Department reported today that its producer price index dropped 0.1% from November to December and is up only 1% from a year ago. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, core wholesale inflation was up 1.8% from last year, near the Federal Reserve's long-term target level. Wholesale inflation typically has a lagged effect on retail consumer inflation, as price changes are experienced down the supply chain. Yesterday, the government reported a measure of consumer prices that found core inflation remained steady from November to December. Some economists and investors are expecting the Federal Reserve Bank to begin lowering interest rates this year, assuming data continues to show weakening inflation. Thousands of protesters are expected to gather tomorrow afternoon at D.C.'s Freedom Plaza to demand a ceasefire in Gaza and an end to U.S. military support for Israel. The organizers of the March for Gaza are also calling for Israeli leaders to be held accountable by the International Criminal Court for, quote, "well-documented atrocities against the people of Gaza and Gaza's civilian infrastructure," end quote. The event is organized by the American Muslim Task Force for Palestine and the Answer Coalition. Saturday's march and rally are just the latest in a surge of protests supportive of both Israel and Palestine since the conflict erupted in early October. Organizers for tomorrow's event are expecting more than 25,000 people to attend. A second day of proceedings opened today at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, where Israel is defending itself against accusations of genocide. Israeli officials insisted their war in Gaza was done in self-defense and accused Hamas of genocide. Lawyers for South Africa had asked the court during opening arguments yesterday to order an immediate halt to the Israeli campaign in Gaza, which has killed well over 23,000 Palestinians. Following the second day of hearings today, ICJ President Joan E. Donahue said the court would rule on the emergency request to halt fighting, quote, "as soon as possible." A full court decision on the accusation of genocide is likely to take years. And the U.S. and Britain launched a round of airstrikes against more than a dozen locations in Yemen following months of attacks on commercial vessels by Iran-backed Houthi rebels. The U.S. Air Force said the strikes targeted various facilities, including munitions depots and air defense radar systems. In a statement, President Biden said he would be willing to authorize future strikes, quote, "as necessary." Houthis say the strikes killed at least 5 people and wounded 6 others, and rebel leaders promised retaliation. Thousands of protesters gathered in Yemen's capital to denounce the U.S. and Israel. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 49 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 48 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert Drowns. Thanks for listening.